Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud, folks. When government does things they have no authority to do, then it is fraud. Okay, on top of that, as we continue to learn, we can articulate our needs in our prayers better. So learn, pray, and act. By the way, the reason we need to act is because we have the power, and He will bless us. But again, that power, knowledge is power, only when we act upon it. So try to act upon the knowledge, not upon your feelings. In other words, and let's see how quick GR can get into a rat hole and come back out. When we start understanding the Constitution, we should be able to argue constitutional points. When we start arguing regarding the mores and values and conservative ideals, then we've lost context in the argument on the Constitution, and therefore we will lose. When you talk about abortion being immoral, being wrong, it is not the right thing, this is just wrong, then you are not, using an argument that will not win. Because who cares whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent? That is a subjective position. When you point out that abortion is not an enumerated power for this government to be able to exercise in the state of Wyoming, in your county, then you will win that argument because you're placing constitutional context that power does not exist. So this is how we learn, pray, and then act upon these things that we're learning. We got to stop using our emotions as a part of our argument. And on top of that, the whole secret, the super secret, if you don't have the decoder ring, that's okay, you don't need to buy one. The super secret that nobody understands, other than, I believe my audience, you do understand this, but you need to start impressing upon people the importance of holding people accountable to their oath and their responsibilities as a citizen. We are all responsible to support and defend that Constitution. And if necessary, pick up arms and use deadly force to protect and defend and support that Constitution. Therefore, we need to start getting everybody attuned. We need to get the Department of Justice attuned to actually using all of its power to getting our public servants into compliance. Folks, if it did that, it would clean up the states, and the states would actually be on task and they will be like a guided missile with absolute intelligence in initiating Republic review and holding the federal government accountable to the Constitution. Because I tell you, even though the federal government will want to do it, the states must take a stand. The states must deliver directives to say these were violations. Even if everybody's finally agreeing and doing the right thing, it is still incumbent and required by the states to say you had no authority, and never again will we allow you. And that way it becomes ingrained in granite. It's ingrained in the stone, the foundation moving forward, that the state's responsibility is to keep that federal government in check, just like the county's responsibility of keeping that state government in check. And then again, we the people keeping that county government in check with its constitution. We've got a lot of work to do, folks. But it's easy peasy, very simple. And welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
Was that not an impressive going into the rat hole and coming right back out?
It's great.
If you heard that snap, that was my elbow trying to pat myself on the back. No, I hate being arrogant, and I come across that way. But You know, sometimes I can get succinct. Sometimes I can and do that. But a lot of times there's just my mind is flooded with way too much. I don't want to call it garbage, but just information that might have some relevance. That and sometimes I think when I fire hose all of that stuff, it's just too much where people don't get it, or you know, it's they lose the message of what I'm trying to say, and I don't like that. So I want to be more like that good me just a minute ago. Anywho, we're still going through Madison's notes on the Constitution Convention. And actually, when I say we, it's really more Tammy, folks, and I will concede that without her, but in all honesty, I could do this, but I would actually do this and I'd fall asleep. And I don't mean that I'd fall asleep because it's boring. It's just that I've done it so many times that giving other people the ability to do this really benefits them, and I believe it benefits you because you also, you the listener, will hear us read it, and then we have a conversation about it. And usually what comes up in that conversation will hopefully be the questions you'll be asking when Tammy says, well, I don't know. Like, I think the other day I said, how many, you know, what are the two major ports on the eastern seaboard? And, you know, who knows those? I mean, that's ancillary. I mean, who really does all that type of information or care about it even, right? And so, you know, your answer is, well, I really don't know, and which is okay. That's not like it was a test just to prove your worth, because that wasn't the case. The point is that when you look at what those major ports are and how they've shifted to actually go to the locations that just make it simple. I mean, it's not that Boston isn't a port, and it's not that it doesn't have significant commerce. There are key ports that where we receive probably most of our commerce into. Seattle, L.A. I mean, San Diego has ports. I mean, San Francisco has ports, and Oakland has ports, and they're kind of significant. But actually, when the last time I looked at the data, Seattle and Los Angeles were the two key ports that had the most amount of tonnage moving through them on a regular basis, and New York and Louisiana, New Orleans. And that's just because when you really look at the origins of where everything's coming from, most everything coming into the East Coast is coming from Europe. I mean, how much products and production does Africa bring into the world? Well, they bring some, and same with South America. So would it be smart to go all the way up to New York to bring, you know, induce that into the American market, or a closer port? So that closer port being New Orleans. Not that there aren't other ports. It's just that when you look at the tonnage, now the numbers may have changed. Louisiana may not be, New Orleans may not be that port. But a while ago, it was Seattle and L.A. and New York and blah. So anyway, just to help us get grounded so we can move forward, we are picking up where we left off, where we were actually talking about the admission of new states into the Union. And so Mr. Governor Morris was about to make a move, or he moved the, and actually I'll just start it off with, he moved that the following proposition as a substitute for the 17th article. Now, the 17th article being the Constitution that they're working on at this time. And I think I also stated that, as you see, the Constitution is yet, and we're talking, what day is this? This is August 29th, Wednesday the 29th. How many days is it to where they actually sign the Constitution? 2 weeks away. So they're still talking about an Article 17 of the Constitution. In other words, it still hasn't taken its final form. As they've been building and building and building, then, and that's why I'm saying, I guess it makes it easier to finally close on what you want the lines to say. But I think more importantly, you know, being able to do that easily in the days you don't have a computer, in the days you just, you know, printing words out is just, they don't even have typewriters. It's all hand done. And, you know, if you're going to write it permanently into a tablet of stone, that's done by a chisel and hammer. So anyway, so he makes this move and he says, quote, "The new states may be admitted by the legislature into this union." Now, he's talking about Congress. "But no new state shall be erected within the limits of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such state as well as the general legislature. The first part to union inclusive was agreed to without any contention." So in other words, this is what they kind of agreed upon. Now, Mr. Martin, and I'll let you pick it up from here.
Okay. Mr. Martin opposed the latter part. Nothing he said would so alarm the limited states as to make the consent of the large states claiming the western lands necessary to the establishment of the new states within their limits. It is proposed to guarantee the states. Shall Vermont be reduced by force in favor of the states claiming it? Franklin and the western country of Virginia were in a like situation.
Okay, so Mr. Martin, and actually, I usually have the delegates involved in this open so I could tell you what state Mr. Martin's from. But unfortunately, I don't have that. And so what I need to do is go look that up. But in other words, on Mr. Governor Morris's motion to substitute, etc., it was agreed to. And actually, when we look at it, New Hampshire was against it. Connecticut, New Jersey was against it. Delaware, Maryland was against it, and everybody else. So it looks like it wasn't actually, was it agreed to? They say it was agreed to.
One, two, three, four, five. I see five no's. Six, yes.
Wow, by the skin of their teeth, it was agreed to. So that's how close things were. Now, what we're talking about is he didn't like the idea that they could play with the sovereignty of a new state joining the union. Now, the language is obviously not where it needs to be. So as we go down, Mr. Sherman basically comes out to make his complaint. Go ahead.
Sir Sherman was against it. He thought it unnecessary. The union cannot dismember a state without its consent.
Okay, that makes sense. So, Mr. Langdon.
Mr. Langdon thought there was a great weight in the argument of Mr. Luther Martin and that the proposition substituted by Mr. Governor Morse would excite a dangerous opposition to the plan.
Now, you know, here that's an interesting thing. You know, Mr. Martin, his last name being also a first name, and his parents thought it wise to make a play on his name, Luther Martin, instead of Martin Luther. Anyway, you see how parents basically, you know, do something to their child that forces them into something? Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Johnny Cash song, A Boy Named Sue. Anyway. So let's keep going, though. So, Mr. Governor Morris, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Thought, on the contrary, that the small states would be pleased with the regulation as it holds up the idea of dismembering the large states. Mr. Butler, if new states were to be erected without the consent of the dismembered states, nothing but confusion would ensue. Whenever taxes should press on the people, demagogues would set up their schemes of new states.
And that makes sense, doesn't it? In other words, when all of a sudden you're not happy with the direction of your state, should you be able to secede from your state? At this point in time, the states that were created via charter and became independent sovereigns autonomously because of the Revolutionary War. The reality had not set in that as all new states come to join the Union, these states will be structured in the same manner as the federal government is being structured as they speak. These men being delegates from the states are creating a federal or a general government to serve the sovereignty and preserve the sovereignty and dignity of the Union and the states. Therefore, the states are the parties to that compact. And they kind of understand this here. They haven't really opened their minds to what they were doing because they've yet to talk about it. How are new states truly being formed and being admitted? They will have to be organized and created not by the federal government because they didn't want the federal government the ability to control how a state was to be formed. Other than it must be Republican in form, the state must form itself into a Republican form of government. Is this making sense?
Clear as mud.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So when they start admitting states, what the federal government does is it basically tells each of the counties based on their population how many delegates each county would send into a convention just like this, and that as delegates, they would basically be working as just that, delegations. In other words, each delegation gets one vote. In other words, when you look at the, when you look at the Constitutional Convention, each state had one vote. This is why they couldn't move forward without, getting the small states to get on board. So in other words, they couldn't concoct a plan that would have submitted the small states. This is critical because in the concept of creating a general government, every delegation has the same authority, or basically this is where the equality comes in, based on the county itself. What is a county? A county is a perpetual entity created by the people to serve them and with delegated powers to do specific things. Even though we have failed to create county constitutions, it doesn't take away the dignity and the sovereignty of the people creating that county and the sovereignty of that county because it was created by the people. Therefore, when the counties go into this, what ended up happening is they started functioning in a democracy. In other words, all of the delegates got to feel important because they felt equal. And the reality is that there should have been a bit of, I will say, humble pie served in some of these state conventions, because this becomes problematic. And you were on a phone call with me with somebody in Wyoming who took exception to the equality of counties as the way I was portraying that. And I don't know if you remember that, but it wasn't a person that was all blue. Anyway, because that person was basically talking, no, counties aren't important in this state. Absolutely not. He's absolutely wrong. Counties are the ones that created your state. They are the parties to that compact. That is the they were created with that foundation, and in contract law, it doesn't matter what you do with law or what have you, you cannot wipe that out. It's like you cannot wipe the parents of a child. The genetic code is always there. And so even though there's not a physical genetic code, like I said, the sovereignty and the dignity of the people in creating that government is equal to all other counties in that state. Even though they may not have the most population, the most populous county, and so therefore they may have the least amount of delegates, but as a delegation, they are equal to the most populated state or county when you work in delegations. Isn't that interesting? Because in a Republican form of government, the dignity of every entity is equal. Just because, let's look at it this way. I'm just going down an aside. If you have all of the county judges the chief judges of the county. Some counties only have one judge. Heavily populated counties like King County of Washington State has several judges in their court, in the county court. And so they have a chief justice. And so when you get all of the county justices into one room, even though there may be a greater role and probably even a higher pay and more envy for this one judge because of his pay, you call the chief justice of another county something other than chief justice because he's just as equal as the chief justice of King County. He may not, he may be the only justice and being the chief justice, but it doesn't matter. His title is the same and his pay salary is based on the same thing. The, if you really look, in most states, the way they judge the pay salary was based on, you know, so many dollars per person that, you know, were within the county. This is how, that's why judges in more populated counties can make more money. And it just, it defies my logic as to how judges became elected. Judges should never have become a popular vote thing. And the way that they, you know, they hide behind this nonpartisan crap. Oh, we can't talk about our records. You know, it's like they hamstring the people and they, you know, they give them this good feeling. Well, I was duly elected by the people. I think that they need to be appointed. And I believe that every, you know, they get a term and every time their term is up, it should be left over to whomever, and I believe it should be the legislative body that should actually be, you know, maintaining and managing that based with the advice and consent. So like if you have a bicameral legislative position in the county, because you have that many judges, then the Senate in the county, along with the executive, advice and consent to the executive, would, you know, then nominate the replacements or who's going to fill that seat. But these lifetime terms got to go. The framers were completely wrong, because actually this was, if you really look at the origin of the lifetime term of a justice, I believe it was Hamilton and others that argued for that. And I think in their day, they thought that that was the right thing to do. No. As a matter of fact, I think one of the things they failed to see, I mean, no, this is really a rat hole. One of the things that they really failed to see in the design of the Constitution is being Republican in form. When we look at Congress, it is truly Republican, and it represents two separate sovereigns. And they are representatives of very specific and different bodies, i.e. the body of the people and i.e. the body of the legislature. Now, the president is equally representative because the president is not selected by the people per a popular vote via democracy. He is chosen by electors who are representing the people to choose for him. And so, in other words, it moves away from a popular vote completely to an electoral college vote. Therefore, he is representative. The justices need to be equally representative. And the best way to do that is to give them a 6-year term, a 4-year term, whatever floats your boat. But when their term is up, it then shifts to the executive of the state, the executive of the county, and or the president of the United States to actually start filling these seats. And so I'm okay with actually maintaining classes, meaning creating 3 classes. If you have 9 justices, that means each president, or, you know, and if you do it by a 4-year period, then each president will have the opportunity to reseat 3 justices. But actually, at the constitutional level, this is the interesting part. At the federal level, it needs to be more representative, not based on the president of the United States. So wait till you hear how it needs to be done so that it is truly representative of the states. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So when I'm talking about justices being appointed by the executive at the county level, it would be by the executive there. At the state level, it would be by the governor. And so the governor would be able to, if you have, I don't know how many justices you have at the state level. Based on the size of the state, it may be less. So, in other words, the governor may actually be only needing to appoint, you know, one if you have three. So, because you should always have an odd number. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so you need to maintain an odd number of justices if you have more than one. You need to have an odd number. So it needs to be three when you have justices of the county or at the state.
Five.
And in Wyoming, you have five?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You would think that Wyoming would only be three based on its population, because that seems to be a little bit excessive for the amount of people for that type of a position. Anyway, because remember, government needs to be sustainable by, you know, its tax base. You know, you don't create extra positions because there's people that want to get paid more money at the expense of the people. So anyway, I would, you know, heavens forbid I be the one to tell everybody what to do. These are just suggestions, but it should be odd. And so at the federal level, for it to be representative of the states, each state, the governor would appoint one justice from their state to sit on for a four-year term or whatever, the Supreme Court, so that the Supreme Court would actually be made up. And since Alaska or Hawaii, whichever is the last state that joined the union, from that point on, there would be 50 justices, and the chief justice would be selected by the president. And he would serve a term for however long, so that the chief justice could be changed from one president to the next. If you do a 5-year or 4-year, 6-year term, however you do it. But nevertheless, if it's an even number of states, then you only need to have one. If it's an odd number of states, like when we have the 51st state step in, the president will then have a responsibility of adding a alternate chief justice or a justice that would not be the chief justice. And does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to have enough justices so you never have a tied vote.
Right.
Okay. So
yeah, he just appointed our attorney general to be a new justice.
Oh.
Bridget Hill.
Gordon? Gordon did that?
Yeah.
So in other words, that attorney general was probably a flaming liberal. Because yep. Gordon's a flaming liberal. And so, you know, the problem is we need to change the Constitution to remove these long terms and permanent processes so that a sitting judge can quickly and easily be removed by the next executive or when their term comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah,
you know, you want to make sure that if you have more than one justice that, you know, you have, you know, probably three classes, so the one justice gets replaced If it's three, then it would be one justice replaced every 2 years, every 4 years, what have you, whatever you make up. But you want to have that overlap to ensure that, you know, you don't have three justices starting off from ground zero, picking up cases that are being managed. So that all being said, at the federal level, this is how we actually have a representative republic, because too long we have had the Ivy School of Communism dictating the direction and actually violating our Constitution. In other words, when you look at where all of these justices have come from, they've either come from the left now is picking really low bar, leftist judges that have, you know, come from leftist probably schools or what have you. I don't know Jackson, where she's come, but most of them have all been products of either Harvard, Yale, or what have you. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not representative of the nation. That is way too one-sided of ivory tower, contorted and revised constitutional theories and so forth. This is why they get away with murder. When they can, you know, when they create laws that actually lend to death, then boom, they're getting away with murder, like allowing health care to be regulated. Now that every government regulation that goes into action and people die from it, whether it be from Fauci's orders, whatever, all that blood actually goes, some of the blood goes on their hands, because they should have actually said this is not enumerated. The federal government cannot do this, and therefore this is a state issue, and get rid of it. But they don't have the ability to enforce that. But the message from the Supreme Court should have went out to the states. Hey, states, you need to step in. But instead, they all work among themselves at the federal level and go, okay, Congress, you got a little problem. You need to do this to kind of legitimize what we're trying to do here in assuming all power. I mean, they work together in taking these 50 states for a ride of destruction. I mean, they're all working to destroy us. They're not trying to preserve the Constitution. They're not trying to preserve the Union. They're all, you know, taking their, you know, their opportunity so that they can make, you know, history with this decision, like, you know, Hugo Black and the Scopes trial, and or I think it was Blackmun with Roe v. Wade. I mean, these names of the judges go down in history. It's like, you know, I forget. I think it was Taney that did the Plessy v. Ferguson. He also did the Dred Scott. So anyway, let me get out of this rat hole. Bottom line, when we look at our form of government, it needs to be Republican in form and not allowing states because of demagoguery to be created. It's the same thing. We don't want... It's one thing if the state is violating the Constitution, then the people of that state or counties of that state have a right to be able to secede from that state. Just like under the federal Constitution, when a state is being punished or being, you know, basically using tyranny upon the state, all of the states are suffering. And some states are suffering more than others. We need all the states, instead of seceding and dismantling the Union, we need to preserve the Union and the Constitution. We need every state to actually start enforcing the Constitution and taking back that federal government. So the last thing we want to do is actually start seceding. But I honestly think you want to start getting push come to shove. I think that there should be a large effort by counties to secede and create their own state. And their argument should be that this state, like the state of Washington, who is basically taking away these constitutional rights of the parents and these other assertions and so forth, they have created an argument for the counties to stand up and say, look, this government is not working out in accordance with us and that U.S. Constitution. The state of Washington is trampling all over the Constitution. Therefore, we have a right to secede. We want to create our own state. And under the, under the fundamental tenets, as Madison taught us, under the fundamental tenets of contract law, when the creature created by the compact is violating it, and you can't get a full consensus to get that creature into compliance, then you have a right of preservation to step away. It doesn't mean that we're leaving the union. It means that we don't have to be subject to that state anymore. And if this information actually started proliferating into Oregon, Washington State, California, and so forth, many states would start subdividing. Instantly, they would start subdividing because the counties would start organizing themselves, demanding a constitutional convention where they actually, the popular states don't allow it because they don't want to recognize, unconstitutionally, they don't want to recognize the county government because they have better representation. When you look at LA, San Francisco, and so forth, because they have super representative bodies because of the unconstitutional change of the government into legislative districts. I know this is really a lot of deep stuff, but I can actually, if I had the time, to go through a whiteboard to kind of walk you through what the Supreme Court did in the 1960s by creating legislative districts instead of and marginalizing your county. Because the counties was what created your state. And the counties deserve and have a right to representation. And everybody let this happen because we were all illiterate. I mean, I didn't realize this stuff until I actually started studying it. And I knew that for a long time how this was all unconstitutional. But until I wrote the article, Why Counties Matter Most, it was just, you know, a bunch of words in my head. You know, and me professing from a microphone. But now that I wrote the article, prove me wrong, folks. Prove me wrong. This concept of what they're talking about, because right here they're talking about Mr. Butler, going back to this. If new states were to be erected without the consent of the dismembered state, in other words, if a new state could pop up out of the state of Washington, like all of the eastern states or all the eastern counties said, we're out of this. We don't want to have anything to do with this. And oh, by the way, you other counties, if you want to stick around, you're going to become the brunt, you know, of their dirty work because we're the ones that are paying a good fair share. Now that we're not going to be around to pay that fair share, they're going to come to you with all barrels blazing. In other words, what you're going to have to pay for, and I'll just say this, because Seattle has made it a state authority of using the ferry systems for these opulent people that want to have their own island and live on. And so these ferry systems are paid by the general public. And as far as I see this, and I could be wrong, as I see this, the people of the eastern, who don't even use the ferry systems, are funding it. And that, to me, is absolutely wrong. I mean, if you want to live on an island, you need to come up with your own means of getting over to engage in commerce, get a helicopter, hire somebody. But if you can't afford to, you know, commute in those ways off of an island, then don't live on an island. Because it's not our job to remove the consequences of your stupid decision. Oh, I got a right to get in there. You got to give me a ferry. And so Washington State has a very extensive ferry system that costs the people a lot of money. And it's a general cost to everybody. Because they realized if they made the people, only those people who use it, they couldn't run it. So what they had, so because there's a lot of tourists that use the ferries. They come up and get on a ferry, go to this island, you know, camping or whatever. But I'm just telling you that it's just absolutely unconstitutional because there's nowhere in that Constitution that I know of that is the people have delegated them the ability to create a ferry system, manage it, and basically tax all the people for it. So what he's saying here is that demagogues would be able to set up their schemes. I believe Mr. Butler is failing to see that a state could get to a point where it becomes tyrannical, where not demagogues, but constitutional arguments arise from the dust. And actually people start saying, hey, we do not have to submit to this government. They're violating our rights. We have a right to break away. And as a matter of fact, if the federal government's not going to put them in check, then we have a right to put them away or put ourselves away and break off and create our own state. This would actually start forcing a dialogue that nobody in control of government wants you to have. Because when it comes down to compliance to the Constitution, you have a right to demand this. The supreme law of the land, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, enables that right and actually secures that right, that every public servant that violates their oath and fails to support the Constitution must be removed. You're no longer eligible to be in office. Okay, so let's go down to Dr. Johnson.
Yeah. Dr. Johnson. See, this is what happens. I
went down a rat hole for so long we forgot where we were. Okay.
I've got it marked.
All right.
Dr. Johnson agreed in general with the ideas of Mr. Sherman, but was afraid that as the clause stood, Vermont would be subjected to New York, contrary to the faith pledged by Congress. He was of opinion that Vermont ought to be compelled to come into the Union. Compelled, huh?
So that right there flies in the face. In other words, they're laying out these arguments back and forth of whether they can, whether they should, or whether they can do these things. They're still working this out, and they're actually looking at whether Vermont ought to be compelled to come into the Union. No, you can't compel a state. A state has to, if a state forms, now here's the problem I have. If the state is a resource of the United States, i.e. the Louisiana Territory, the United States paid for that. And so this is the brilliance of Thomas Jefferson. He realized that the United States used money from the states to pay for this large section of land. He also realized that within the Constitution, they didn't have the authority to grant land to Indian tribes. Therefore, to do that, in other words, they couldn't create a reservation. They couldn't set aside land to say, this is for you to inhabit and for you to occupy. So he submitted an amendment to the Constitution in 1803, getting the states to grant the federal government that authority. Congress didn't even want it. As soon as they realized what this was going to do, they didn't even want it. There was no way they were ever going to grant federal property, or I should say property of the Union, because technically it's not federal property. Everything is property of the Union. The states own everything. The federal government is limited on what they own, and we've gone through this before. They have to pay for what they have. And at any point in time, the states can always say, you know what, this isn't working. Goodbye. Get out of here. So yeah. as we look at this concept, there, as the federal government started going down after 1803, because Thomas Jefferson wanted to give a big part of that land to the Indians. The very central part of the mount going all the way over to the mountains and towards the northern part of that was going to be Indian land. And so the swath that would basically go across the north over to Washington State, down the Pacific coast, and across the southern part of this large gap that would have been created, the United States would have formed with a hole in it where a sovereign state of Indians would have been created. That's what Thomas Jefferson wanted to do. And technically, we could have done that. And if the Indians wanted to, you know, work with us and say, okay, well, we want to buy this land from you, but they didn't want to play. In other words, it's kind of like as society, as children grow up, some children advance into, you know, and a family continues to grow. Some lines of the family just never get, you know, to advancing and to working with everybody else. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, society across the world has been moving forward. And it's not like Western society has basically colonized the world. everybody who was engaging in commerce started realizing, okay, so to protect our sovereignty, look at China. China may have been, harassed by the world empire, but many nations that were conquered by that world empire basically took their country back. That world empire being UK. Now, every other country, because bottom line, that country that owns the land and manages it and works its way forward with a legal system and so forth, there's no reason why these nations or these tribes couldn't have basically recognized, hey, if we want to preserve and live this way, we need to at least be able to pay for, we need to get engaged, we can't just continually play the life we play, hunting and having fun. We actually have to be responsible because the world is going to swallow us up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I don't mean to make it sound cold and callous, but the reality is if somebody comes along and they get to a point where, you're just struggling. And yeah, you have this land, but pretty soon that land becomes so hard. And I guess the conditions can become so hard that ultimately you end up having to sell your land or what have you, because that's what would have ended up happening. What should have happened as the federal government created reservations when states became sovereign states, because technically the treaties, the federal government did not have the authority to create a treaty to be the supreme law of the land for an Indian nation or a tribe to be, commuted to a parcel of land. They didn't have that authority in the Constitution. But under the guise of Article 4, Section 3, they did have the authority to make temporary laws regarding that territory being prepared to become a state. So when they created the law of we're going to regulate the Indians onto this land, when the state became a state, that land became state land, and the state governor, technically what should have actually happened is when the state became a state, it should have had its own militia. But the federal government was bringing states into the union faster than they could actually support themselves. So what did they do? They left the cavalry there to defend and protect when they shouldn't have done that. Governments need to be self-sustaining. So when you admit a government that comes in that you're going to have to continually, tend to and care for their security when they can't secure themselves and protect themselves, you've created a problem. And actually, the people that have allowed themselves to come into the union have no idea what they're doing, what's happening to them, because now they've got this dependent relationship with this government that should not be in that relationship with them. It becomes a huge mess, and nobody saw it. And so, it's easy. I think what I do is probably the easiest thing in the world, because I find the problems and I state the obvious. That's a problem. They should have seen this coming. And what I'm saying here, what Doc Johnson and Mr. Butler are talking about, I think that these men had no idea the problems that would have ensued had these ideas gone into the Constitution.
Yeah.
You have to give and you have to secure liberty both for the state, for the people, and their counties, so that when that state is created, it is created properly with the proper relationship from the counties to the people. Now, and I think we could sit down, it would take some time, but we actually started thinking, how could these tribes have actually, because technically the Cherokee, go look at the history, the Cherokee was beating the white men in their own game. They had their own newspaper for the people. People were buying their paper. They were engaging in commerce. They became they were a real threat to the southern states because they couldn't compete because their people were too lazy. So they complained, and Andrew Jackson committed a huge sin and a transgression against the Constitution by putting the Indians on a trail of tears. What he should have done was he should have said, well, okay, it sounds like you need to start including them. They should be citizens. You need to, because they are integrating into our system. They're engaging in commerce and so forth. And they should have been considered as, you know, taxed people and as U.S. citizens, and they should have been protected.
Yeah.
And I believe that would have actually put America kind of on the right track. Because that was the intent of Washington. That was the intent of I can't say Adams, but definitely Jefferson and Madison and even Monroe. These men were seeking ways of preserving liberty for the people. So with 2 minutes left, let's go down to Mr. Langdon then.
Mr. Dickinson, yeah. Mr. Dickinson hoped the article would not be agreed to. He dealt on the impropriety of requiring the small states to secure the large ones in extensive claims of territory.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Wilson, when the majority of the state wish to divide, they can do so. The aim of those in opposition to the article, he perceived, was that the general government should abate the minority and by that means divide a state against its own consent.
Okay, and then Mr. Morris.
If the forced division of states is the object of the new system and it is to be pointed against one or two states, he expected the gentlemen from these would pretty quickly leave us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And so there we go, and we actually now close that day, that chapter, and then we dive into Thursday, August 30th, in the convention. And so they resume the discussion of Article 17, where they're talking about admitting states into the Union. And they pick up right where they left off. And so with basically a minute left, we can really see how they needed to get on top of this process. Now, we're talking about August 30th. The Northwest Ordinance is already passed by Continental Congress in July. That was actually creating a set way of the people that lived in the Northwest Territory, how they would be integrated into the Union based on, agreements that under this Constitution would have been unconstitutional based on how the Constitution ends up. Because the federal government could not manipulate new states. In other words, where the way Continental Congress was functioning, they were functioning as basically trying to have to create treaties for new states to join. Now, there was no talk about the apportionment of these states, but then again, in Continental Congress, the apportionment would have been kind of equal for these states coming in. But the concept of actually being controlled with religion and some of these other factors that were included into the Northwest Territory, they became moot. The Northwest Territory was superseded by the Constitution because of the way it would have managed the admission of states into the Union would have been a direct conflict with the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, as they kind of go through this and as they come to, you know, a clarity of how to admit states, it becomes a very simple and beautiful process, ensuring the self-destiny and determination of each state and the people. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.